This is episode 3 alpha of Free As in Freedom. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is Free As in Freedom.
So we've gotten we're 3 episodes into the FOSDEM talks, and things have been going a little more slowly than we had hoped as far as getting things out. We're all volunteers here, and Dan did that Linux Outlaws Live, and it's hard for me to complain that he took time out for that because they donated the proceeds to Conservancy.
Oh, so that's super awesome!
I can't really complain that they took time out to
great.
Do that.
Thank you, Dan and Fab.
Yeah, and as you might guess, doing a live event, it takes a lot of time when you organize a live event. So we didn't hear from Dan for a while after before and after the live event, which is totally understandable because those things take such effort to coordinate and organize.
Yeah, absolutely. So I hope people understand. I've actually had occasion to see a few listeners in person recently. I think, Bradley, you probably have too. And it's been a funny thing trying to explain to people, like, I'm sorry, the episode's coming, there's something more coming. So thank you for being patient.
And also, this editing we've put forward to Dan is more complicated than what we usually give him, because we've got these recordings we did it on a recording device. Obviously, we used a device that he recommended, but we never used it before, and we probably didn't place it in the best possible place in the room, and so he's had to do extra work to sort everything out and get the audio working.
He's awesome.
So now we're moving through, and this is the third talk of the FOSDEM track in February.
This talk is, I mean, a lot of the talks are great, but this talk is really great.
Well, it's interesting because on the plane ride home, Richard Fontana said to me, you really need to listen to Gabe's talk. He said, this is Gabe Holloway, who's a law firm lawyer, giving a talk.
Yeah, we just looked up his affiliation because we're so impressed with his perspective that we wanted to know sort of where he was coming from professionally, and were surprised, I guess, to see that he seems to be at a law firm.
And the only reason we're surprised about that is because, I listened to the talk not having read his bio. I was out of the room at the time.
Yeah, me too.
And, so neither of us were in the room, so we didn't see him, we didn't meet him. I didn't see him at all at the conference, actually. I didn't get a chance to meet him, unfortunately. So I listened to the talk just on the audio. I just had it on my HTC Dream, just playing it, walking around. And so I heard the talk basically not knowing, only having read the proposal initially that he had sent in. And it sounded like a talk from a free software activist who happened to be a lawyer.
It sounded like a talk from someone at SFLC or someone whose law career had taken them somehow. Or maybe even somebody in-house at a company who cared a lot about doing the right thing.
Well, it was clear that Gabe was involved with free software. First of all, he said free software, not open source, which was very interesting. And you'll hear that in his talk that's coming up. And so he was already involved with the free software movement, it sounded to me, before he went to law school, before he became a lawyer. It looks like he probably did undergraduate in computer science or was doing computer science as an undergraduate in some way. So he was already involved in free software before that. You made the point to me that he came at this from a principled perspective as opposed to just a legal perspective.
Yeah, it sounded like someone who came at this from a principled perspective. And you when you listen to it, see what you think. And I guess we'll talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, so this is Gabe's talk. And for all these, we haven't mentioned in the previous two episodes, but we will try our best to get the slides. Tom Marble is doing a great job trying to collect the slides from everybody still as we record this.
Can we thank and applaud Tom Marble in every episode?
Tom does most of the work for this track. It's the four of us. It's me and Karen and Tom and Richard Fontana. But every year, Tom Marble does, the 2 years now, Tom Marble does the 90% of the work of organizing the track, basically.
Yeah.
And basically all the other three of us do is read all the proposals and help decide what the order of the, actually just who's accepted. Even Tom did even the order. So
we
just decide who's accepted.
We talk and agonize over various other matters that come up over the course of dealing with the track. But Tom does everything.
Yeah, so he's still collecting the slides from everybody, and so every time we have the slides, they will be on the website, the FAIF.us website. But I listened to everything up till now, including Gabe's talk that you're about to hear. I listened to it all without slides. I didn't have any problem
hearing without slides. Yeah, I listened to it without slides too, and I forgot that I didn't have slides because it didn't seem necessary.
So I think that's why I didn't mention in the previous episodes you about slides possibly being available, because I think the talks were okay without slides. So enjoy Gabe's talk, and we'll come back after.
Here's Tom introducing Gabe.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Gabe Holloway. I'm a attorney from the United States, and what I'm speaking today about is what I think is an emerging and likely to be in some areas a persistent problem in the cloud provider space, which, and I'll unpack this in more detail as we walk through and then leave, if possible, ample time for questions and discussion. But that emerging problem is essentially public cloud services and providers that are using free software essentially as the basis of their service offering, but they're essentially sandboxing it or locking it up inside of a cage where the software comes in under free and open source terms, and it never really is permitted under both technical and in many cases contractual restraints to exit that environment. And I think for a lot of reasons that are obvious to this audience, that can be kind of a persistent harm to the larger communities that are developing that software. So let's start with kind of the concept here. I guess I'm going to just use a use case. Is those of you in the room that are familiar with Amazon's Elastic Compute Cloud or EC2, can you raise your hand? Yeah, I think I'm going to pick on Amazon a little bit, not because they're unique, but because we're all familiar with them. Many of us have Amazon user accounts, and we've used EC2. And in particular, what I'd like to focus on is their Amazon machine image, or what they call the Amazon Linux AMI. And for those of you that have used EC2 and you've ever gone through their setup wizard, in other words, you want to provision a new account, you'll see this is essentially the default option. In other words, if you start a virtual machine, this is what they present to you by default. This is a custom Linux distro maintained by Amazon, and approximately 1,200 to 1,500 packages in addition to kind of the core of the distro that are also maintained by Amazon, that is provided for use on their cloud as essentially the de facto option. And this is going to sound like we're really picking on Amazon a fair amount, but I do want to emphasize this is not unique, though it's also not a problem across all areas of the cloud. There are certainly cloud service providers who are traditional Linux systems vendors or Linux developers that are, beautifully open about what's going on in their cloud, about making that code available to the public and the communities at large. But I do think, given the influence of Amazon and some of these other more closed public cloud services, we see this across a number of different sectors. So let's think a little bit about what these actual restrictions are. And I'm going to place them into two categories. The first set of restrictions, and the ones that I suspect many of the audience members will have encountered, are the technical restrictions. And these are essentially tools or mechanisms that are built into the design of the cloud, or the way in which the machine images are managed, and the source code for those machine images that keep them locked within the Amazon domain or Amazon running instances, or the domains of whatever the other cloud providers are. So what I'd like to think a little bit about here, and I'm going to quote a little bit from Amazon's own FAQ, and if you look at some of the other service providers, you will see similar things in their FAQs, or in many cases when this question comes up in user forums. But, quote, "The Amazon Linux API is only available for use inside Amazon EC2. So the idea here is that you've got a system image, a machine image. It's customize a little bit. There are folks that are more technical in this audience that have told me that it's essentially it's a Zen-based image with some, you know, some modifications to the way in which it's loaded and unloaded. But the idea here in the FAQ is, you know, this lives and it's tied in to the service. Perhaps more importantly for this audience, source is available for nearly all parts of this image. But the command line tool provided, quote, in the Amazon Linux AMI enables viewing of source code inside Amazon EC2. This, you know, think a little bit about this. I mean, this is essentially a source depot that's designed to live within a, you know, a virtual cloud environment. So it's a distributed, in some sense, network available source depot that in some ways is very unique, that it's designed to only be accessed within that limited sandbox. You know, I can't really think of another system or service where it's almost as if it's a distributed network depot that's designed not to be cloned and accessible remotely. And other than you know, with some of my clients that are dealing with remote vendors or doing development work where they have things that they're trying to keep private or non-public, those are the only other situations where I've seen something like that. And the other thing that's interesting from a technical constraint with this system is, and I don't know, have very many of you in the audience actually tried to check source code out of some of these public cloud-facing infrastructures? It's a level of almost aggressively negative user interface. And what I mean by that is the model is you check one source package out at a time. You authenticate with your username. You exchange a key that was issued to you by the cloud service provider, presumably so they can, I don't know, track who's making the requests, how often these requests are happening, that they aren't necessarily happening in batch. And then you pull that package. You're able to examine it. You're even, and we'll get to the contractual restrictions in these agreements, but you're even encouraged to rebuild that, though you know, you may no longer have support for that package if you need to make a modification or troubleshoot a bug. But the idea here is really a technical mechanism to make source not only not publicly available, but also to restrict its usage within narrow technical constraints. And I think, as a practical matter, you know, I first ran into this as a user of a couple of these cloud systems, wanting to troubleshoot something, and basically being confused by the lack of documentation as to why I couldn't, you know, request a source package without providing my key and going through a lot of authentication routines. And so, you know, I started to dig in a little bit further and talk to some other folks who are in this space, and then also examine some of the contractual restrictions. And what I mean by that are essentially the legal restrictions that are in the service agreement that I'm sure almost none of us in this audience read. I mean, some of the lawyers may, but and not to pick on Amazon again, because I think that their service agreement actually is one of the more permissive service agreements in this space of kind of public cloud providers. That you know, that being said, it's still pretty horrifying from a free software perspective. Meaning that, and this is going to be a lot of legalese, but it really is reflective of something. I'm sure some of the attorneys in this audience may admit to, or at least I will admit to, which is when you don't really know how legal risks are going to play out around a client's offering or solution, you often end up punting the problem down the road a little bit. And in this context, that means you reserve a lot of rights. You have this huge reservation of rights, and you give a pretty limited license. But in essence, what the Amazon terms of use and their customer agreement asks, which is as I said, you know, more permissive in my experience than many of the others in this space, is they grant you a limited, revocable, non-exclusive, non-sublicensable, non-transferable license to access and use the term solely in accordance with this agreement. You retain no rights or obligations under this agreement from us or the licensors, including any intellectual property rights. I would characterize that as a very broad, you know, in a license, there's a very broad reservation of rights. And then where things become even more troubling when you combine the technical inaccessibility of these source repositories is the license restrictions. And these are so long, I had printed out the license restrictions, but they were, you know, a couple of pages. And so I'm just going to cherry pick a few that, like I said, these are pretty friendly license restrictions in the space, but they're still quite burdensome. Neither you nor any end user may or may attempt to modify, alter, tamper with, repair, create derivative works of any software included in the Surface offering. It's a broad carve-out for things that Amazon may actually distribute to you under an open source license, meaning if they publish an API on Amazon.com. You may also not reverse engineer, disassemble, decompile the service offerings, apply any other process or procedure to derive the source code of any software included in the Surface offerings, and then a lot of other legalese. And then perhaps what I think is almost, I don't want to say shocking, because it's common in the proprietary or commercial software field, is there's a very broad non-assert, which in some ways I think actually ties back into our license compliance panel this morning. At least for all of you that have raised your hand saying that you use EC2 or the Amazon AMI, by using EC2, you are agreeing that during and after the term, you know, during your use of the service or after the term of the service, you will not assert, you will not authorize, assist, or encourage any third party to assert against Amazon or any of its affiliates, customers, vendors, business partners, licensors, any patent infringement or any other intellectual property infringement claim regarding any of the software on the service offerings. So if you're a copyright holder, as I suspect a number of folks in this room and at this conference are, in some of the software that's being used by Amazon within this sandbox cloud environment, you're essentially agreeing not to assert your license or enforce your copyright rights against them if they're in non-compliance. Maybe just to reset for a moment, why does this seem wrong? If this is the emerging model of at least the public cloud, and I'll get to in a moment, well, is this enforceable, even if it's wrong? Can you do this? And I think there are some interesting legal questions around that. But first of all, I guess maybe at a gut instinct, it just feels very unfair. This audience, it feels unfair too, but I think there are a lot of audiences, who are less passionate about free software that it also feels unfair to. Because what we're talking about here is essentially infrastructure as a service offerings, meaning that these are products that are sold to us or to our, you know, clients or customers as being the equivalent of bare metal, but off running on some sort of utility computing infrastructure. And if you were to take this, you know, out of the cloud space and into the physical realm, meaning if I approached you as someone, you know, selling you some hosting solution, and I say, okay, here's your physical computer, there is also an operating system that you can install on that physical computer, it's Linux, or here is a stack of Linux plus database images, plus server images. Here are 1,000, 2,000 copyleft license packages. I hand those off to you, which is basically the virtual equivalent of what we're talking about here. And I say to you, listen, go ahead, run those things, modify them. I'm even going to give you the source code, you know, on those disks that you can install in this machine, but don't dream, of taking that source code out, and I'm going to basically put a little device to monitor whether or not you've extracted that source code. I think many of us would be back at the compliance panel earlier today saying, well, you know, isn't that a violation of the GPLv2 or other copyleft licenses that those packages may be under? And isn't this a situation where we've had a distribution and after that distribution, someone has imposed additional restrictions upon the materials I have received that are, you know, a violation of the underlying copyleft license. And I guess in some measure why this feels wrong to me is the distinction between the physical scenario and the cloud scenario where you upload your virtual image or you run a virtual image in the cloud, it's very thin, I think, to a lot of developers or a lot of system administrators. It's just a choice of where do I get my resourcing from? Do I run that computer, you know, in my own data center, or do I outsource that data center to someone else? And so I think that there's a fundamental fairness question. The other thing that to me feels wrong about this, or at least at odds with principles of software freedom, is at least in part, and I have to speculate here, it also seems like this is being done for purposes, for business purposes, of vendor lock-in and for lack of portability. I mean, why aren't these images available to be run locally on your machine? I could certainly think of a number of good use cases where it would be beneficial for me to run one of these images on a local machine to do testing, to, you know, stage deployments. Yes, I've got some transaction costs in uploading these images back into the cloud. But the main reason, from my point of view, that I think many of these images are less than portable, and that there are these technical and contractual restrictions on moving them, is because the entities that are selling these services or providing these services don't want the software to move, despite the fact that they're benefiting from software that was developed under the ethos of free software development. And it really comes back to one of I guess the principles of what I wanted to present to you, which is what good is complete and corresponding source in the cloud, Freedom One, if it's in a sandboxed proprietary environment where you're essentially denied use of it outside that environment, and you're lacking freedoms 1, 2, and 3. It's not just an issue of keeping code out of the commons, which I think is obviously a problem, but it's also an issue of, I think that there's, at least when I first encountered this, there was a gut reaction, well, you know, this must just be something of convenience, meaning that these are only minor or trivial modifications. So what's the harm to the commons? I know for a lot of ethical reasons there's a harm just in not working upstream. It's a bad business decision. But, I may be, unfortunately, one of the few people curious enough to go out and query a fairly strong sampling of some of these packages within these environments. And, yes, many of them essentially appear to be taken from upstream sources, but the ones that are most critical, the ones that are most performance-driven, the ones that, service providers are soliciting bugs and getting user feedback, in other words, the ones that have pain points that work is getting done on them, they're, in those packages, there are not necessarily trivial modifications. They're not necessarily, just consumption of the upstream projects. I think, if left unchecked, and if the business case for contributing upstream is unable to be made to certain of these cloud service providers, this can have a pretty destabilizing impact across even those upstream projects. Because what we have, I was, in full disclosure, I was one of the complete skeptics on the Affero GPL. and the AGPL V3. I thought the whole ASP loophole was kind of, you know, we were worrying about all sorts of things that were never going to happen. Why are we spending so much time on this? There was so much sort of anger and consternation about this as a problem where it didn't seem to be an active bug in the software communities or in the legal communities around free software. But I think in a world, and I'm really glad there's an AGPL V3 panel later today who I suspect will be talking about some of this, but in a world where the AGPL V3 is largely being adopted, in my view, for the wrong reasons rather than the sort of ethical reasons to adopt the AGPL V3. In other words, it's a stick rather than a carrot. You know, this is a compelling reason to adopt it for reasons of software freedom. And so I've talked a little bit about why this is happening, but I want to maybe play a little bit of devil's advocate as someone who advises a wide range of clients. You know, why would service providers of public clouds choose to take this model? I mean, given, you know, we've got a lot of believers, obviously, in this room around the efficiency and the benefits of contributing upstream rather than taking narrow forks and keeping them private. Well, one, I suspect, is the lower surface area for discoverability. Meaning, you know, if you're a competitor of Amazon or some of these other cloud providers and you want to know what's going on in their system, it's nearly impossible to do so under both the legal agreements and some of these technical restrictions. And it's basically impossible to take some of these modifications or changes that have been made and port them to other situations or other environments or cloud stacks. The other thing that I would call out, because I know that it's a real factor in the United States, though less so here in Europe, thankfully, is the more information you expose on the web, especially for some of these big services, the more surface area you present for patent lawsuits. Meaning, the easier your code is to find, if you're one of these commercial service offers, the wider customer base you have, the more likely it is someone is going to be able to easily dig in, and a patent troll or a competitor is going to be able to leverage a U.S. patent against your service in a way that's disruptive. The other thing that I think may be a factor, especially coming back again to this morning's compliance panel, is this approach essentially imposes on these commercial cloud providers zero compliance costs. I mean, they don't have to. The reason, just to be clear, that much of the source code is available for many of these packages inside of the cloud environment isn't for compliance reasons, which you often see at least be a material factor in a lot of other traditional Linux vendor scenarios. It's because it's really good because the customers want the code for certain of these packages, because they may have changes that they need to make, or they may have bugs that they want to check. In other words, it's being provided within the sandboxed environment with no means to really extract technically or legally, only because that's necessary in order to use the system, not because it's a compliance issue. And so as a practical reason, I suspect it wouldn't take a great deal of effort actually to go from that environment where most of the source is being provided inside of a sandbox to something that is, if it was publicly available, would be, compliant in terms of source availability obligations. But it means that no one has to pay attention to those issues. The legal departments in these cloud service offers and the release managers no longer have to go through that checklist and manage that life cycle of compliance, which I think is often perceived as a significant, a significant investment and distraction by many development teams. And lastly, I mean, not to sell my own tribe out, lawyers are just kind of paranoid about new models of, you know, the cloud is relatively new as, you know, the conversion of software that does real things rather than just be, you know, a dumb access mechanism to a application as a service. You know, infrastructure as a service is a relatively new model. And as someone who has struggled to advise clients who are using cloud services or maybe offering private clouds in some situations, we have no good idea or guidance about how to approach some of these legal issues, which, you know, brings us back to one of the points I was making earlier. Our temptation is basically just to punt these issues, to let them, to kick the can down the road and say, okay, I will reserve as many rights for my client as I can, and I will give as few rights contractually as I can get away with for my customers, meaning that many of them won't read this carefully. If they do read it carefully, it's likely because they have a large legal department and maybe we'll specifically negotiate something with them. But, you know, the average customer will just take these terms as they're presented to them. I think perhaps to at least the attorneys here, one of the most interesting questions here is this an enforceable set of constraints? Meaning, under the relevant copyleft licenses, is it enforceable? Under common law, are the contractual restrictions that have been placed by many cloud service providers onto their consumers enforceable? First of all, I'll just come out and tell you what I think. I won't quibble. But I'm dead certain that there will be differences of opinion among many of the attorneys, and I will quibble around EU and EC law because I'm more ignorant in that area than I would probably like to admit. But let's assume that there's no AGPLv3, and I can tell you from accessing two or three of these cloud services and kind of running through some of their license packages, either there's a scary coincidence that they just haven't used AGPLv3, or they likely have some sort of blacklist policy. I mean, if I was operating a system in this way, that would be at least one, you know, one thing I would watch out for if I was trying to kind of exploit this hack of some of the older licenses. But I think, at least under the GPLv2 in U.S. law, my view is this is probably okay, unfortunately. I've been chatting with some friends and colleagues about this emerging issue in the cloud space, and I wouldn't say that there's a consensus that it shouldn't be okay, that it feels wrong and in violation of free software principles. But you know, if there's no transfer of a copy, in other words, if the technical restrictions work unerringly, and if the transfer of the copy is not done at the volition of the service provider, in other words, someone has to do a very elaborate hack to route around these technical protection mechanisms, you know, this is likely not is something that is. is permitted under the GPLv2. Under the GPLv3, you know, I think at least in the United States, the arguments are largely the same. I know we have folks in the audience who were very deeply involved in the drafting of that license, but at least the original stated intent was that there was, you know, really supposed to be no difference between the distribution in the GPLv2 versus v3, and there's the clause in the text of the GPLv3 that mere interaction without the transfer of a copy is not conveying. I have talked to some colleagues in Europe, and hopefully someone will. I will solicit comments during the question section from some of our European colleagues who have told me that they think that there might be some interesting corner cases. In under GPLv3 in Europe, in particular, because under the GPLv3, propagation includes not only copying and distribution, but also making available to the public. And that, that's a concept that we don't really have under U.S. law. You know, in the European Union, there's the copyright law, as I understand it, distinguishes between the reproduction right, which is roughly equivalent to our U.S.-based distribution right, and the right to communicate to the public or to make available to the public, which is at least specifically intended to cover certain publication scenarios and transmissions across the internet. It may not have been the intent of the GPLv3, but I have at least one attorney in Europe who has argued to me that that the trigger for making available in Europe may be much more passive than that in the United States. In other words, essentially providing a public-facing surface or service with each of these, with all of these components and the source code for them, and if it's possible to technically effectuate a transfer out of that environment, may be enough of a making available or communication to the public to at least argue on this point. Like I said, I'm still not sure that at least in the United States, we don't have that same line of copyright copyright principles. And the GPLv3 also says that propagation, which is the further hook for conveyance, must be an act that without permission would make you directly or secondarily liable for copyright infringement. And I do think this is maybe one of the reasons that cloud service providers are contractually restricting these issues, because if they contractually restrict it and you do manage technically to pull it out, they may not be engaging in an act that would make them not primarily liable for infringement, and likely not contributory liable or secondarily liable in the United States. This is a far tangent, this is probably the most sophisticated free software legal group of attendees I've ever been amongst, so I figured why not touch on it. I think as a practical matter, the fact that some of these questions around the cloud are probably a little closer or a little tougher in the EU means that I think EU law will actually be driving how far these cloud service providers and others can exploit some of these what we would call bugs now in or many of us at least in the GPLv2. And another thing that I'm also I don't know how much of this is ill will, I don't know how much of it is ignorance, but it does result in I think in my view at least in a community harm for these upstream projects. And I'm not sure what good responses are, or at least what effective responses will be. Because, community pressure is one thing, but I'm not certain for certain entities that have been antagonistic towards free software, community pressure isn't going to necessarily be effective. I don't think business pressure, unless the costs of developing and supporting these forks becomes untenable, is necessarily going to work. And it really does bring me back to I think a point I made earlier, which is this may be an instance where there are very good reasons to argue for actual migration to something like the AGPLv3. Even though that license has not seen the sort of uptake I think a lot of its early advocates were hoping for, and many of the adoptions have been for kind of icky reasons, it may be, from a lawyer's point of view, the best legal solution to this sort of problem. Really what I have for you, so I'm happy to take questions or comments, if there are some.
Thank you for your talk. Yeah, perhaps from the perspective of a European lawyer, I think it's not so much a question of copyright law than interpretation of the licenses. And it seems to me that interpretation is different in the US and at least in Europe or Germany. So for me, GPL2 does not say anything about cloud services. What we have in the GPL2 is running the program is unrestricted. And for me, running the program unrestricted does not mean it's in a cloud service just running, but it's much closer to distribution. So to give an example from the proprietary world, if I buy a copy of Microsoft Office in Europe, I don't need an additional license for Microsoft. Running the program is allowed by copyright law. But if I put that software in the cloud and allow people against some money to use Excel and they can use it, of course that's much more. That's much more. I need a license for that. And the question is, where does a license come from? And if I ask this question to the GPL, I would say, I need to have an interpretation because there is nothing like making available in the GPL from the wording. And if I say yes, it is allowed because the idea of the license is to allow any use of the software, what is correct, then I have to look, but what are the obligations? Mm-hmm. Is the intention of the license no obligation or to provide the source code? And I would say it's not just running internally, but in many cases, if customers use the software in the cloud, it's similar distribution, you have to provide the source code. But that's my personal opinion, it's my interpretation. On the other side, GPL3 and HGPL3 are clear about that, because it's connected to the word conveying, and conveying is transferring a copy, that's a definition in the license, and that's mostly not happening, and then under GPL3 you have not to provide the source code. That's why if I have a client who want to be sure that in the cloud the source code has to be provided, I recommend HGPL3.
Yeah, I think that's the only way to make certain of this is AGPLv3. But what's really fascinating about that comment to me as a U.S. lawyer is that, I agree there is more, I wouldn't say complete clarity, but there is more clarity under this sort of scenario, certainly in the AGPLv3 and arguably in the GPLv3. But to view the GPLv2 because of issues of license interpretation as perhaps having a broader set of requirements even than the standard GPLv3 is something that I think, at least in my experience, the U.S. bar hasn't been, it's not their perspective under U.S. law. Any other questions or comments?
Yes? It seems like what you were saying was that the GPL2 is not a sufficient protection to require source code because there's no active distribution, and distribution is a trigger under GPL2 to make things happen. And I'm wondering, what does it take to what constitutes distribution? Is it just letting me? If you're giving me a copy that I'm running on a borrowed machine, to me that feels like distribution.
Well, I think this is a very interesting question. The rule of thumb given by a lot of U.S.-based lawyers around distribution, and distribution under these sets of license varies by jurisdiction, as does conveyance. I mean, consult your local lawyer. We hate saying that, but we keep doing so. But the rule of thumb in the United States is normally transfer to another party. But the argument here is that, all of this is being done within a single domain. I mean, it's essentially like your you know, you're remotely interacting with this machine. And I do think that there's an argument to be made, at least from a gut instinct reaction. I have so much access and control over this cloud machine. It's so similar to, you know, if I had a physical computer here, that it should be deemed to be something like a distribution, because not to do so would be wrong and inequitable. But I think under you know, the guidance upon which so many folks, at least in the United States, have been relying on GPLv2, the conventional wisdom, and even under U.S. copyright law, as long as it stays within that sandbox, the better argument is probably that it is not a distribution, that there are no source availability obligations, despite the fact that seems fair, because these cloud service providers will also, in their contractual pieces, essentially ask you to agree that, hey, they won't come out and say it, hey, this is not a distribution, but they'll say, you know, you are using these services, we are providing them to you, you are running them on our hardware and infrastructure, we control this. Essentially, they will build that evidence chain to demonstrate that this is not something that's been provided to you in an unfettered way where it would be distribution, and you have the right and ability to copy it independently. Yes, sir.
Thank you. For the last years, I'm talking notes that much what was previous products and now turned to services. So I checked my local law, mostly just checking what's different between if someone's selling me a service or someone instead of products. And found in Swedish law, I found that there are a lot of rules that are blankly ignored nowadays. Of course, those laws were designed with the thought of someone sort of building your house. What should, how are they thinking of what law they? That is what the law was thinking of when they designed laws. One of those, for example, that if you're selling a service, you as a seller must have some legal obligations to make sure that the buyer is aware of the benefits and the cost of what you are selling. And no service provider is making sure legally that I'm aware what I'm actually getting, aware what actually I'm paying for.
I think that's a very good comment, especially about the lack of transparency of many of these services. This is what, at least in the United States, we often, or at least I refer to as kind of the collision between what we often think of as copyright law around these licenses and consumer protection law, as we would have them in the United States, which is, listen, you just can't sell this raw of a deal to people without telling them that it's, you know, that this is what the outcome is. And transparency is the way to solve that. But I think we're given the infancy of these cloud services, we aren't likely to see much in the way of FAQs. And to, you know, not to pick on Amazon, because I do believe other cloud services are worse. It's just that we're all familiar with them. At least they're coming out and saying in their FAQ, hey, this is only for use within this cloud. Hey, the source is only available from within EC2. To a certain degree, I respect that, because you can know it up front, and maybe it's part of the bargain that you've engaged in. But it's I don't think it's necessarily the level of disclosure that we would be looking for to protect consumers and users and to let them know what's happening and what the trade-offs are of a product versus a service. Any other questions?
I've got one. I think this is really strange that by just putting software in the cloud, you get to have what I might call a walled garden contract, where the walled garden contract allows subsetting rights of what I put into that box and adding additional restrictions. It's as if we replaced cloud with black box computer, and you put software in the black box computer, all of a sudden I can take away freedoms 1, 2, and 3. It seems really weird that it's possible to do that.
I think that that's why, you know, to a lot of folks with development backgrounds, this seems fundamentally pretty unfair. And ultimately, the people to blame for this, in part other than the cloud service providers, are likely The lawyers, yeah. I mean, it's and it's not necessarily the lawyers trying to interpret this. It is in part, but it's also the fact that a lot of these issues that we seem to persistently discuss at these sort of conferences around what constitutes a derivative work under European or U.S. law, and all of these frustrating issues where attorneys appear in front of you and they say, well, consult your own attorney, here are some broad rules of thumb, but there could be exceptions, that's a flaw. You know, well, one could also argue it's part of the beauty of the law, or at least lawyers are indoctrinated to believe that. But from a development perspective and from a guidance perspective to large groups of communities that are relying on these licenses to essentially, in part, negotiate or mediate the ethical bargains that they've made between themselves and their users and larger communities, it's a big flaw. And so I do think that, you know, the emergence of walled gardens in this space is something that I don't want to say it's inevitable, but it seems to be happening, probably partially through design and probably partially through ignorance.
Well, let's just to build on that a little bit more. Maybe this isn't just about copyleft software in the cloud. Maybe we could talk about copyrighted works in any walled garden. And let's take a counterexample. Let's say I took some proprietary licensed music, but I put it in my shiny new pirate player. Mm-hmm. It's a pirate player, and that means I get different rights than if I were to buy this from, let's say, a music store. Would people think that's okay?
Well, the law is a sad and many varied thing, I will push back a little bit on that to say, I think fundamentally under U.S. law there is a distinction between a service and, you know, a distributed shiny disk. Now, whether or not ethically, as free software developers, we believe that distinction is fair, when it's being fully exploited to the largest extent it can be. That's probably not the case, but the fact is that, you know, if this seems wrong to you, the ASP loophole is probably something that is, you know, now more relevant than it was a few years ago. I know we're approaching the end of the session. If there are other questions, I'm happy to chat with folks during the break, but I am hungry for lunch, as I suspect many of you are.
Thank you very much.
By this talk.
Yeah, as we said before in our comments before we played the talk, I think Gabe is coming at this from the view of a principled free software person. I was obviously happy to hear that he was at first skeptical about the Afero GPL and now feels that the Afero GPL might be really important.
Well, yeah, I was surprised actually at the course of the, I mean, I spent some time in the room but also elsewhere since FOSDEM is so crazy and there's so much going on. But I'm always surprised at how often and how overtly people talk about the, you know, nefarious-like uses of the AGPL now, and how that's become just sort of like a standard topic of conversation.
Yeah, and there's more on that coming up in future episodes about the Afero GPL specifically. Now, there was one part of what Gabe was saying that I felt was slightly alarmist. His view that when you connect to, say, an Amazon service or any other of these VPS-style cloud services, I hate the phrase cloud because I don't think it means anything, but one of these VPS-type services where they deploy an operating system for you, my view is that, so immediately you can install rsync, and you can make an entire copy of the thing onto your own computer. And the fact that they give you that immediate access and ability to make a backup, in fact, they encourage you in a lot of the sites, they're like, you know, you need to back this up, and if you don't have a backup, you know, we can't assure you the data will still be there. They basically goad you into accepting, into making a copy. And my view really is that if you can rsync from the server, they set up a server for
you. I thought he was saying that's actually not permitted.
Well, I know people who use Amazon. Well, maybe he's talking about different
services. I've never used the service, so I don't know, actually.
So one of Conservancy's
priorities... It sounded to me like he was saying there are technological measures in place to prevent that.
I heard him saying that too, but the standard VPS you get from Amazon, I know because one of Conservancy's projects uses it. I won't say which one, but one of our projects chose to use Amazon. I wasn't happy about this, but that was what they were already using before they joined Conservancy, and there was no reason Conservancy could really object per se. Actually, I'm going to talk in a minute why Conservancy may have wanted to object, but we didn't. That's another thing I want to follow up on Gabe. I'll get to that in a minute. But certainly they can make an rsync of their entire operating system off of the thing, but the whole file system, they can copy it, including all the packages that Amazon installed for you.
See, that's news to me from what I heard Gabe say.
Well, but I'm wondering, and I'm going to follow up with Gabe and talk to him in more detail, and if I get more information, we'll talk about it in a follow-up show. But my question for him is going to be, which specific service is he talking about? Because obviously Amazon and all these other services have many different types of services. Here's a great example. So I just helped a Conservancy project set up a really basic web hosting account. Mm-hmm. So in that case, all they can do is copy HTML and PHP files to a specific directory on the system, and they aren't even able to examine the binaries that are running, like the PHP binary that's running, the Apache binary that's running, because they don't have it's set up as a virtual host on a server that probably has lots of people's web hosting.
Right.
In that case, they're not receiving distribution of Apache, they're not receiving distribution of PHP, because they are just using a little SFTP connection to upload a few files to put them into place. So in that case, I would agree, they're not receiving distribution of Apache. They're not receiving distribution of any of the software that's running, because they're just uploading HTML and PHP files. And then they're being displayed back
out. I would agree with
you,
if they can just rsync everything, then...
That's distribution. That's my view.
Yeah, I mean, think he's not talking about that.
Well, yeah, and so I want to look into this a little bit further, because really the most alarming thing he said, the place where I was most worried about, was this term that he found in the Amazon things that says that copyright holders who sign up waive their rights of copyright enforcement against Amazon. And that's really troubling, because if Amazon were to violate and Gabe points this out in the talk, that if Amazon were to violate the GPL and you as a copyright holder have agreed to waive your rights, you know, so if it was, imagine a BusyBox copyright. Now, I'm fortunate to know that I don't know of any non-conservancy BusyBox copywriters that have agreed to the Amazon terms. But if they have, right, the Amazon would argue in court that you agreed to these terms and therefore you can't enforce your license against them,
mm-hmm.
Which is a little disturbing.
Yeah.
And certainly that's a term that I think ought not be in there. I think it's probably inequitable in some sense, because to force somebody to agree not to assert their copyrights on a program you're using on every instance...
Honestly, I wonder. I mean, from my knowledge on enforceability, I think there are circumstances where that could be enforceable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these are sophisticated users, and it's all.
I think Conservancy and other enforcers would make the argument that it was just inequitable to ask them to agree to that. And obviously,
but they agreed to the terms.
Yeah.
So it depends. I mean, I've always been surprised at how much, you know, these terms are generally enforceable, different in different jurisdictions and mm-hmm. whatnot. But yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if they wound up to be enforceable.
Yeah, and I mean, my guess would be, and the other thing is that I want to also talk with Gabe in a certain amount of detail to figure out what specific terms and conditions in terms of service he's looking at. Because I certainly know he's using Amazon as his primary example. I know that their different services have all sorts of different terms and conditions. I think this is sort of what it's getting to is, in Amazon, I don't know if you ever looked at their dashboard, but their dashboard is... unbelievably complicated. The number of things you can sign up for and turn
on
and turn off.
Do you have to agree to terms to sign on to access the dashboard?
Well, sure, but the point is that
which
then
you surely read.
Within that, Tony read them on our behalf, obviously, and cleared them for us. So my guess would be Conservancy hasn't agreed to that particular clause Gabe was looking at, because I'm sure Tony would have flagged
it. Right.
So my theory is that Gabe's talking about a very specific service of Amazon's that has these terms and conditions.
Yeah,
I'm going to go over it with Gabe in a little more detail.
That used to be me.
So certainly I'm going to work through it with Gabe and follow up with him about
cool.
this. But I mean, this is why Fontana was telling me I needed to listen to this talk. Now,
that's probably not the only reason Fontana told you needed to listen to the talk.
There's probably other reasons as well.
Hi, Richard.
We related to GPL his obsessions with GPL enforcement and enforceability and various other things that Gabe was talking about. Now I think Gabe is focusing on Faro GPL as sort of my impression is he's looking at it as sort of an easy solution to some of this, because it makes it much clearer that anything you would put up on a web service like that has to be copyleft into the web service space. And I probably agree with him on that it would be an easy solution. For example, if Linux were Faro GPL, just mm-hmm. imagine, then Amazon wouldn't really be able to wrap any terms of service mm-hmm. of this nature around it, or even try to, because it would be a clear violation of a Faro GPL, because you'd be restricting people's right to modify the software and so forth. So I think that would be that would be an easy solution, but I don't think it's as dire. I haven't looked at the specific, sat down with Gabe and looked at the specific terms and conditions he was identifying and figured out, you know, when do they apply, when don't they apply,
which services. Maybe we should try to have a follow-up show with him.
Yeah, I'm thinking we might. Basically on Conservancy, and this goes back to Fontana urging me to listen to it, on Conservancy's behalf, I really want to talk to him, because obviously if Conservancy is using these VPS services, the primary VPS service we use actually is Gandhi, because Gandhi was kind enough to donate a very large amount of services to Conservancy last year. So a lot of our projects are using that, because effectively it's free to them. They don't have mm-hmm. to pay for it. So that most Conservancy projects are now using Gandhi simply because they gave it to us. mm-hmm. And we thank Gandhi for that donation. But we use all sorts of different VPS services. Our projects use the whole gamut of anyone you've ever heard of. There's probably one Conservancy project that's using that one as a one-off. So from Conservancy's perspective, it's really important we understand this, especially given that Conservancy is a holder of copyrights for these projects and in some cases, and otherwise has a responsibility to these projects. We need to vet these kinds of issues to make sure our project developers aren't giving up rights just to use a VPS hoster. I mean, that's kind of it's kind of crazy to think that you would have to give up your rights under copyleft licenses just to use a VPS hoster.
Yep.
And we could put pressure on Amazon and others to change their terms. I mean, that's always difficult. I think that's kind of hopeless in most cases to try and pressure.
I don't know. I mean, I've actually been successful at doing that sometimes in the past. I can think of at least one situation where I got a company to change their terms because they really didn't sit well with us.
With GetHome, you mean? Or
actually, it was when I was still at SFLC, and so just with the free and open source software communities. Mm. So, I have actually started to work on a few things on GNOME's behalf too.
Yeah, my general feeling is that you often don't have enough weight to do it. I mean, this is sort of when we're going to talk about this in the next episode about not everybody, but large numbers of people thinking that, oh, it's so hopeful, we'll convince these app stores to do what we want them to do and they'll change their terms. I said this last year on the app store panel at FOSDEM, and I think it continues to today, that it's very difficult to convince companies to change terms that they've put out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, we just need a more coordinated effort is what we need.
Well, I certainly think things like boycotts can work.
The
certainly.
Time I was able to do it was because I knew exactly the right people to contact.
Yeah.
So that helps a lot.
And I think boycotts have worked. I mean, there was a boycott of Amazon on patent issues for many, many years. And while I supported the boycott, I don't think it actually changed, was the reason they changed their patent policy.
Right.
I think that they realized that one-click patent was not particularly enforceable, and so they decided to stop enforcing it because it wasn't cost effective for them to enforce it. I don't think anything to do with the fact that the FSF and others had called for boycotting of Amazon due to patent aggression.
I don't know that boycotts are really that effective. I think
they are if you get enough people.
But I think it's so hard to do that it's more effective if you positively approach a company.
Well, you should always try that first, but if that doesn't work and boycotts are your
answer. Trying to approach a company and trying really hard to approach a company.
Yeah, I don't like the idea I think Gabe sort of points at this in his talk, this idea that we should beg these companies just to do something we like and that we basically have left ourselves beholden. I think part of Gabe's point is with these kinds of services, given that they're often the default for deployment of online services and so forth, being beholden to these companies is a dangerous thing. And allowing them to set these terms. And Gabe's point, I think, was that they're that everybody, I mean, he kept using Amazon as an example, but he was very clear to say that they all have very similar issues of this nature.
And I
wonder if he's looked at Gandhi. I bet he probably hasn't, because Gandhi is such a small. One of the reasons Gandhi gave us this big donation is because they're such a small player, and the fact that I would say they gave us a big donation is a big deal to them as a promotional aspect. But certainly it's not. Certainly the smaller ones I think are less likely to have this kind of, like Linode, I don't think probably has this kind of aggressive
terminology. Yeah, I don't know. I
really doubt the smaller ones, that particularly ones that came more out of the community, like Linode, which is really a it came out of Linux user groups and so forth using it.
I thought it was fascinating that he mentioned that he thinks that European law is going to drive some of this analysis because of the analysis over what's a derivative work and what isn't. I thought that was really interesting, because maybe this is my U.S.-centric perspective because I'm based in the United States, but it does seem like often the U.S. law is what drives some of this discussion internationally. So that was kind of...
Yeah, we're going to hear people making reference to that very issue in later talks, certainly, that issue of the U.S. driving it. But I think that when you look at there's been more, just to go back to GPL enforcement, which Gabe was sort of hinting at, that somehow this might be a GPL issue, the enforcement in Germany has been more legal, as far as lawsuits, there's been more lawsuits in Germany than anywhere around the world, including the United States.
Right.
So in some sense, on GPL, Germany is leading the world because of Harald.
Right.
As far as lawsuits, I think we've, not to be competitive about it, but I think we've done more enforcement in the U.S., but we've done fewer lawsuits than Germany has.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, you know, I'm not sure, actually. I mean, because I think that to some extent the licenses, many of them were drafted originally with U.S. law in mind and then later adapted for laws of other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense also U.S. law is driving the issue.
Yeah, I mean, my view is, and we'll hear me commenting on this in later talks, that the Berne Convention, with U.S. being country of first publication and the place where the license is coming from, Berne Convention sort of gives us a certain standard that says basically the work can be the legal issues can be interpreted under the local laws.
It's just
a country of first publication issue under Berne. And signatories of Berne, I think, speaks to enforceability around any Berne Convention country. I mean, at least that's the doctrine that we've went with in free software, and I think it's borne out to some extent that works. The fact that
I don't know that it's borne out.
Why don't you think it is?
I mean, why do you think that it is borne out? I mean,
well, because you've got Harald enforcing on a set of copyrights in Germany from a work Germany wasn't the first country of publication, and you know.
Well, sure, I think so, but what laws were applied and what analysis was applied, and how would that play out in other jurisdictions, especially when you have multiple publications and different versions and authors in different places?
Well, you just use the local copyright laws are usable for that. And I mean, I can imagine GPL having trouble in a country with no copyright law. So if you pick a country that has no copyright law, hasn't signed the Berne Convention.
Oh, well, sure. I mean,
I can always imagine that happening, but are there countries where you can do anything? I mean, there's corrupt countries, small corrupt countries where horrible things are happening. Are we going to worry about GPL enforcement there? You take countries in Africa where there's genocides going on. I don't think worrying about whether the GPL got enforced in that country is really the top priority in any sense of.
Yeah,
but
there are some jurisdictions where copyright is not respected. To be fair, the top problems in every country I can think of are potentially more important than copyright.
True.
So what I was actually going to say is, you know, if we care about copyright in any jurisdiction, you know, we care about them in all, and you weigh the ills in society, as best you can, and work on things that you can
Right. But I mean, if you take a country where you have a corrupt government that's exterminating its people or something horrible like that, as happens in some cases, if that government were violating the GPL, I don't think I would have any specific concern about that, chasing that violation. You know, that regime is so corrupt anyway that they're killing people, like, so they violated the GPL.
You can say that about any country.
Well,
we have such societal wrongs all over the world in every single country, and we're going to worry about copyright?
Yeah,
I mean, sorry, I don't mean to be so aggressive about it, but...
Well, I mean, the U.S. is not committing genocide anymore, right? So, we're at least we're not actively exterminating Native peoples like we were a couple hundred years ago, so...
Yeah, but we have a lot of...
We don't have slavery anymore in the United States.
We have plenty of societal ills here now.
True.
There are a lot of areas in society that if I had the ability to just fix problems in a row, I'm not, you know, copyright would be a little further down the list.
Okay, I agree with that. I just think that in the...
It just seems like a silly argument to me. I mean, we work on the things that we can work on and make a difference and improve things in the world and hope for the best. And sort of like bringing up that argument is tough.
My point is that if software freedom is being disrespected in a given jurisdiction, you sort of have to weigh that against other ills happening in that jurisdiction. Yes, there are ills in the U.S. There's problems with healthcare in the U.S. There's problems with poverty in the U.S. and so forth. But they're nowhere near as bad as they are in some other jurisdictions. So I've often said this about software freedom that you have to, society has to get to a certain level of non-corruption, a certain level of equity in human existence for software freedom even to be on the map as an issue to worry about.
Yeah.
And I've always believed that software freedom is not the most important human rights issue. I believe it is a human rights issue, but it's not the same as, you know, freedom of speech. It's not as important as a right to not be oppressed and all those sorts of things. So my point is that in the jurisdictions where oppression is so bad,
I actually disagree. I think we both worry about this. You know, the logical conclusion of that rationale is truly that we should close up shop in working on free software and instead start working on causes that affect people's, you know, people's health and their well-being.
I considered that I was doing the wrong thing multiple times.
Oh,
right?
Me too.
That I wasn't working on these other issues.
I think you can't, like, try to make the world a better place and not evaluate whether you are working on the best cause or not. That's happened to me very recently. There's a cause that I care very much about.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually somewhat selfish.
And can I actually make a plug for it? It's not one of these human rights issues. Actually, it is what I consider to be very fundamental, which is that the Cooper Union is where I had my, where I got my undergraduate degree from in engineering. And it's the only free as in no charge university in the United States that's fully based on merit. It's an extraordinary institution, and it's having financial issues, and it looks like it's going to have to start charging tuition unless a lot of donations come in very soon. So if you have some spare money and you're looking for a non-free software-related cause, please donate to the Cooper Union. It really, having a place in the United States for secondary education that's completely free is huge.
Well, that goes to a bigger ill in the United States that we don't get.
The right to education post
high school is doesn't exist in the United States, where it exists in most of Europe.
Yeah,
and that's it. That's sort of the more fundamental issue. And Cooper Union is a hack to try and solve that problem a little bit, which is now no longer functioning or might not be functioning.
I mean, it's a philanthropic institution. It's still functioning. It's just it's unclear whether. In September when the new students come in, whether they'll be paying tuition or not.
Right.
They haven't actually issued acceptances yet because they're not sure what they're going to be able to do. And the art school, last I checked, had basically said, no, thank you. We'd rather walk. I think Cooper Union should shut its doors before it charges tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And it should take what resources it has and create, scholarship spots at an existing university by donating it what it has. So even if it means there are only 10 spots,
right?
You know, like 10 students at NYU get a free education, it's worth it.
Yeah. I think there's a certain amount of selfishness on my part to work on free software as an issue, mainly because my only thought of what I could do for other issues would be with the skills that I have would be to take. Free software, try to convince other nonprofits in working in more urgent areas to switch to free software. Because I thought for a while, I was like, I could just be like a sysadmin or something for some other nonprofit cause that's more of a high priority in culture and society. The problem with that is that they would most likely already be running proprietary software and want me to support proprietary software, which I won't do. So then the next option is, well, you could try and get them to use free software, which I think is an uphill battle. And then it comes back to, well, we have to write certain free software for nonprofits. And so that's what I've tried to do.
That's a problem that we have.
I'm trying to work on it. It might be an announcement soon about how Conservancy is going to be trying to work on that issue. So I can't pre-announce, but I'm not going to pre-announce beyond that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's an issue that I do think is valuable to try and make free software that works for nonprofits, which does address this issue of helping other causes, because other causes have NGOs that need software and we can help in that way. But on the other hand, you know, I thought about whether I should go work for, say, an Amnesty International when I got out of high school and that sort of thing, because that's sort of the, you know, people being imprisoned for their ideas is much worse than people using proprietary software, I think.
Yeah, I think we often sort of have that kind of crisis of identity to some extent. But I think if you can work hard in a way that you can make the world a better place to the best of your abilities and maximizing the skills that you have, then I think that's sort of where I come back to, especially in my medical devices work. I feel like that sort of touches a place where I think a lot of people might not be able to, and so I feel like it's the same thing for you. If we're specially positioned to work on this issue, we should do it because it's important, even if there are fighting world hunger
it was particularly nice of you to maybe nice isn't the right word, but to let your medical issue be something you used for a cause. And it really
sucks.
Well, it's rare that somebody's willing to do that because it's a personal issue, and that's really tough. I mean, it's sort of similar to what people do when they've been a victim of a violent crime and are willing to talk about that their victimness as a way to advocate.
It seems rare, but at the same time, all of the people who are advocating in this medical device safety sphere are people who have, not all of them, but many of them are people who have devices or these implanted devices of some kind. I think I mentioned this on the show before. I was once on a panel with I had an ICD, and two of the people I think had insulin pumps. Mm-hmm. And another one had cochlear implants.
Yeah, but if you count the number of people that have some sort of implanted mental device against the number of people working on this issue, I bet the percentage is really low.
I bet the percentage is high relative to other areas.
Hmm. Okay. I don't know.
I'm curious because I also know there was someone in the audience who wrote a paper who also has an implanted ICD, or that's like saying TCBY yogurt or ATM machine or PIN number.
Okay. So we're a little bit off topic from what Gabe spoke about, and so we should probably
we're far afield.
I think that his raising this issue, it's something we're gonna have to research further. I wish he'd actually gotten more active earlier, because if he's been studying this issue, it's a major issue that needs to be looked at more carefully. I sort of got the impression that he so I'll tell him now if he listens to this before I get a chance to write to him I want to work with him to try and figure out if we have a serious problem here. I have to admit that I think some of what he said was slightly alarmist, and I need to see a lot of backup documentation before I believe the situation is as dire as he presents it. But I was convinced from his talk that the situation is a serious issue that needs attention with regard to GPL and terms of service and how they interact, and do people have a right to the software that's on their VPS. If the situation is as complicated as he presented, even just a little bit as complicated as he presented, it needs attention. So I'm really glad he raised it. He sort of buried the lead in some sense, because I had no idea from reading his proposal.
I had no idea that
this was what he was getting at, because he sort of made the proposal was cagey enough that I was sort of like, well, what's, I remember we discussed it when we were evaluating the proposal, like, what exactly is he talking about here?
Frankly, it
was on right on the line of acceptance, because we weren't sure. But if it had been a little punchier, like Amazon terms may in fact or VPS hosting terms,
lawyer proposed talks often
might contradict the requirements of GPL, this talk will present how those contradictions might occur. were. Like, right. Like that talk would have like flung to the top of the list.
Yeah, totally. Well, hopefully we'll find out more about it.
But I'm so glad we accepted it. Yeah. I'm so glad we accepted the talk based on the more cagey proposal,
sure.
Because it's so good that we got to hear this, and I hope our listeners will think about this issue and go. I think the most important thing that individual users can do, the most important thing you can do, really, really read those terms and conditions. I think that's a point that Gabe's making here.
If you're using one of these services, let us know what they say.
Yeah, and in this sense, actually NPR covered this. I'll try to find a link to the NPR story that was pretty good about the level and complexity of terms and conditions of websites. They were talking more about the Facebooks and the Twitters of the
right.
world. But the fact that people click I agree to these things all the time, you know, when I'm in a hotel room, I read the terms and conditions of the internet connectivity that I get.
Mm-hmm.
I open that and read it. And usually it says things like you can't run torrents and and we reserve the right to turn you off immediately if we don't like what you're doing and all this. You'd agree not to do anything illegal while on this and so forth. So I mean, it's usually saying things like that.
Sometimes
and I agree to that.
Sometimes it says that you agree to not do anything immoral. And it's sort of like, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I actually have an outstanding question that's never been answered from, I actually had a lawyer look at this from the co-working facility where I work. They have some bizarre terms about the internet access and that make no sense at all. And I actually had a lawyer look at them. Basically, the lawyer told me that this is before we had Tony to do this sort of stuff at Conservancy. The lawyer said, "Well, this this is so vague and confusing. It's probably unenforceable anyway." So we ended up agreeing to it. But then I sent them an email saying, "We're agreeing to this, but this makes no sense. And if it's read strictly, it means this. We believe it means this. Can you clarify for us?" And they never answered.
Of course.
And so it's a lot of it's poor drafting in some sense but that's what goes to my point of it's very difficult to get people to pay attention. I mean, this is a small company in New York that has 6 facilities and they can't be bothered to check their listen to a member who's complaining about the language or that's problematic in their terms. Now we basically agreed that we have a strong defense.
And you have 2 offices, but you only had 1 at the time.
Well, I had 1 tiny one at the time. But the point is that it's we basically came to a legal conclusion that it's that if it would be to read in the worst possible way they sort of couldn't argue and of course their only remedy would be to evict us, and we're sort of like, well, if we're evicted from a co-working facility that's really noisy, what's the big deal?
You like it there.
I like that it's cheap for Conservancy and that our office space line item is not
relatively
high.
Conveniently located.
Well, conveniently located, but and other conveniently located places are so much more expensive.
Right.
And it's very hard to get a sink. This is a hard problem.
Right.
I never thought about this, but getting like a sink area to wash
it's
dishes.
Very convenient if you work from your couch.
True. But the problem is then you have ergonomics issues.
That's true. Actually, my back is killing me.
Yes, you need to be more careful. I've been telling everybody this. People are telling me, I love working on my couch. I keep telling people ergonomically, it's not a very particularly good option because the way people type from couches.
Yeah, I've been trying to fix that, like my posture on my couch.
Well, the problem is what angle are your wrists at? That's what I'm worried about.
Right, but I'm actually more worried about my back right now.
But I'm worried about your wrists.
Okay, thank you.
Because that's the long-term problem. That's the problem you might not be paying attention to.
Right.
Please use ergonomics when typing. We encourage all our listeners to do that. And we encourage our listeners to read these terms and conditions and terms of service. And if you find something, if you have a terms and conditions or terms of service for some service you use, obviously we already know Facebooks and Twitters are horrible. I mean, that's a given. But if you find, and some of Google's aren't great either. But if you find one that's sort of one we haven't mentioned or one that's sort of new to you or something that you find a term that's really kind of nasty, email us and let us know and we'll maybe talk an email about it or talk about it on the show or talk with Gabe about it if we get him on to do a follow-up about this issue because I think that's the big issue is people aren't reading these in details.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for Gabe to go deep into the Amazon ones and analyze them.
Yeah, definitely.
And it sounds like he's analyzed ones other than Amazon as well.
So maybe we'll do a follow-up show.
So, thanks. We hope you enjoyed that talk, and there's more talks coming in future episodes.
See you then.
Freeze and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Freeze and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Freeze and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Freeze and Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us.
I was waiting for you to say, you always have to, the rule is you always say something before you start.